Good morning. If I could have just one or two comments before we get started. One is that one of the things that happened on Wednesday night, some of you were there, many of you were not. One of the things that happened on Wednesday night was that we heard young adults in our church, many of whom I did not know, speak of how they see this church as being a mission point for reaching young adults right around us. And they kept saying, we don't have to go overseas. We don't have to go to other parts of the country or to other parts of the continent. We have a mission field right here. And they were intense about their desire to reach this area. And one of the things they talked about was getting out of their comfort zone in order to be more welcoming to young adults as they got there. That leads me to make a very small observation, and I don't want you to hear me scolding. I want you to hear me encouraging. When folks come in, very often they come in, if they're new, they come in just as the class is getting ready to start. They need a place to sit, and the places to sit are up in the front. And on some Sunday mornings, it hasn't happened too recently because typically they have somebody with them so that it's a little harder to bolt when somebody has your elbow trying to push you in. But sometimes they'll actually turn around and leave. If you want to be a missionary for a little while, get out of your comfort zone and take the front seats first and leave the back seats deliberately for the use of folks who might come in a little bit late and might be a little bit unsure. If folks come in on time, invite them to come and sit with you. Since Mike's not here today, last week we had a visitor, and I introduced that visitor to Mike and said, Mike, could this fellow sit with you? And I watched through the whole time that we were having the lesson. Mike was spending some time talking to him about where to find things in Bible and things to do like that. Let me just encourage you. We do have people who come in and visit from time to time, and when they do, sometimes they have to go find a folding chair to sit in instead of the nice comfortable chairs that we have. And we introduced our visitors, and it is proper that we not introduce this particular couple, but Paige, we got some awful special people with us this morning, and they came in just as we finished that. Would you just take a second and let us say welcome back to them?
It is my pleasure, and it is my heart. Also,
welcome back.
And my son-in-law.
Now, I can't understand anybody wants to sit on
the ground. So,
it was special to see both of you. They were part of our group for a long time. They moved to another church, and we've been aware that things are going okay for them. But it's great to see you in the flesh again, and we're glad to see that. Third thing, there was a moment in this morning's worship service when I had trouble seeing my music. I'm up in the choir, and I don't know if you pay attention to such things, but I went about two verses to where I couldn't sing. Because I saw Donna sitting back there. She was behind somebody else. All I could see was the wheelchair and the artificial leg. She had a radiant smile on her face. She looked... I want to be careful how I say this. She looked so much better than I had hoped she would look when I finally saw her. She doesn't know me. She doesn't know most of you. But I went to her as I hope you will go to her when you see her again. And I just said, I've been praying for you, and you have brought me joy by being here today. And I need to say that publicly. About the same time I saw Donna, I saw Joanna Buckner. And I started thinking about the time that I saw Shirley in the hospital and thought I might not see Shirley again on this earth. And Shirley's back every week. I thought about the time I saw Nancy in such distress. And Nancy's back every week with a radiant smile of her own sometimes. We have been blessed as a group. Sometimes things like that end in separation, and sometimes things like that end in a different kind of restoration of relationship. But today was a special day in so many different directions, it wasn't funny. Now,
Bill, let me just say, yeah. You mentioned about Shirley, and how about Shirley Wednesday night?
If you weren't there Wednesday night, I leaned over to Barbara. You don't know this. I leaned over to Barbara and I said, it kills me that Shirley's health is to a point where she can't have the influence that she used to have. And then she kept talking, and all of a sudden, the whole church She got applauded on Wednesday night because she saw a vision of how older folks and younger folks can relate. You miss it when you don't go to things like the Hot Topics. I thank you for what you said Wednesday night. There are young adults in this class who wish they had foster grandparents for their children. My son-in-law, Barbara told me I had to stay shut up on Wednesday night because my son-in-law was running a meeting. He talked about how when he first came into the church, and I can remember him saying when he came into this church, it's too big, I'm used to a smaller church, we're going to have to look for another church. But among other people, Norma Hamlet invited him out for a meal. And he and Kathy went out and had a meal with the Hamlets. And he said, that's been 15 years ago, and I still remember that meal and what it meant to me about connecting me into this church. It turns out the things that we could do can be relatively simple. They can look like almost nothing to one side. They can mean everything to the other side. If you have ever gone into a new place and stuck, probably you would remember the first two or three people who welcomed you. The first two or three people who paid some attention to you and took some interest in what was going on with you. That's probably the heart of what we talked about on Wednesday night, was how we can get to know all the people in our church, and especially thank you, Allison, generational relationships. Okay. Now, pop quiz time. Last week we had a lesson. Some of you were here, some of you were not. Those of you who were here, what was the lesson last week? Lessons from lepers. Okay. Today, the lesson is lessons from kings. Not the books of kings, but from individuals who were kings. Does anybody sense a trend coming? What else could we have lessons on? If we just go into the Bible and look at individuals in the Bible, what else could we have lessons on? I'm asking in part so I can make sure my list is long enough. We could have lessons from prophets.
Shepherds.
That was the first one I wrote down, and I still don't know what I'm going to do with it. But that was the first one I wrote down, because I think there's important lessons there. What else?
What about women?
Women. That was the third thing I wrote down.
Foreigners. Strangers.
Strangers. Hadn't put that one down. That's interesting. I'll have to think about that one. What else?
Missed opportunity.
Might have to look for that one, too. I hadn't thought of doing that, because I was thinking of individual people as opposed to certain things. But that's an interesting one. I put down soldiers. I put down children. I put down not just women. I put down mothers. So I think there's things. And, of course, when I put down mothers, I have to put down fathers. Right? And I don't know where this list is going to go, but this is what we're going to work on for a little while. So today, the lesson is on kings. Now, most of you know the names of the first two kings of Israel. Few of you will know the names of the next two kings of Israel. And I will tell you, it is a trick question to ask for that. Because in order to answer the question, who were the next two kings, you have to give the names of three people. And we'll have to see how that folds out. Who were the first two kings? Saul and David. Okay? Who were the next two kings?
Solomon.
Good. You got the first one. And then there were two because the kingdom split.
Jeroboam
and Rehoboam. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning. We're going to talk about Solomon and Jeroboam and Rehoboam. I am stealing shamelessly from some things Ravi Zacharias said at one point a few years ago. And I'm also trying to put together some things to help you see this. So, let's get started. First of all, background. See if you can find 1 Samuel chapter 8. Find 1 Samuel chapter 8. It is fascinating to me what happened in Samuel's life, given what had already happened in Samuel's life. When I talk about lessons from mothers, Samuel's mother will be one of the ones we talk about. Okay. Remember the story? A man had two wives. That seemed to be the thing to do in those days. One of them gave him a number of children. One of them didn't. The one that didn't give him children, he loved more. But she could not be consoled. And she prayed. She prayed so deeply in the temple that the priest in charge of the temple thought she was drunk and accused her of this, and then was so embarrassed after he realized that she wasn't, that she was just pouring her heart out in prayer. And he said to her, a year from now you will have a child. And she pledged that child to God's service. And so after he was born, after he was weaned, he came to live at the temple to work with this priest. That priest was Eli, and as Eli got old, he turned the priestly duties over to his sons. And his sons were corrupt in probably 8 or 10 or 15 different ways, each one worse than the one before. And Samuel watched as God judged that and took those two boys away and indicated that Eli's family was no longer going to have influence. 1 Samuel 8, verse 1. Do you see an echo? Samuel gets old. He tries to put his sons in charge, but his sons aren't functioning very well. Verse 3, his sons did not follow his example, but seduced by the love of money, they took bribes and gave biased verdicts. They were judges in the land. And so the people came to him and said, we don't want to have judges anymore. We want to have a king. Now, I'm not going to go very far into this because it will take up all our time if I do. God had said when he brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, I want you to be a special people unlike any other people on earth. I want you dedicated to me. I want you to be a kingdom of priests. And essentially, I'll be your king. So if you look at verse 4, the elders of Israel assembled, went back to Samuel and said, you're old, your sons are not following your example. Give us a king to judge us so that we can be just like all the other nations. Samuel prayed to God, verse 7 and 8. God said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people and all they say. They're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. And this is echoed up in verse 19, 20, 21, 22. God says, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. Give them a king. So Saul became king, and he had some pretty severe problems. He looked like a king, but he wasn't able to function like a king. And the kingdom was taken away from him and given to David. So now we come to Solomon. If you look in 1 Kings chapter 1, this is all still background. It's going to take a little while to build this background, so just be patient with me. 2 Kings chapter 1. I'm sorry, 1 Kings. I've got Travis' problem this morning. 1 Kings 1 and verse 1. I only need the first few words. King David was a very old man. And if you take a look down in verse 5, it says that one of his sons, it names the wife that he's the son of, Adonijah, I think is his name. 1 Kings 1, verse 5, Adonijah. Well, tell me what your translation says. What's the verb and what's the adverb for that?
Exalted himself.
Put himself forward. Mine says grew pretentious.
You want to hear my own?
Uh-huh. Please.
Humble. This is how it's translated in Romanian.
Is it?
Adonijah, the son of Gaetan.
Uh-huh.
Humble up to the point that he said, I will be king as he prepared.
Yeah, humble is an interesting word because I think it's in contrast with what the English translations are saying. But I'm just looking at Judith for a minute because Judith brings in a French Bible that translates from the French on the fly, and it sounds like you've got a Romanian Bible.
Yeah, that's
what 1800s translation.
Yeah.
Put himself forward, grew pretentious. Read of what was the one you said?
Exalted
himself. I think that's closer to it because there's an arrogance, a pride, a pushing forward. And what does he do? What's the rest of the verse? He says, I will be king. And accordingly, he began to be king. He had a big feast. He brought all his friends together, told them all to treat him as if he were king. And he invited everybody except, verse 8, the priest or the person closest to the priest and the king, David. And he didn't invite the prophets, didn't invite David's champions. And finally, down in verse 10, he didn't invite Solomon.
Forgive me, please.
Yes.
I made a mistake.
No.
For you?
No.
Yes.
And Miss Lett.
You're
right.
I was trying to translate it in
some.
I'm so glad.
But
no,
I'm
absolutely.
That doesn't mean you were. It's been a long time. I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, yeah, he exalted himself. Proud.
My memory, it doesn't always work for me.
You're right.
And I cannot remember the name of the city, Ramanu Vishkanal, which is about 30 miles or 40 miles slightly west and slightly north of Ploiești. There is a student of mine from last year who lives there, and she brought me a paper sack when she came back from Romania this last week. She brought me a paper sack with all kinds of information. Judith has been having meals with this kid and a couple of others, and so I think Judith's got a paper sack that she told Judith she had something for, I think. But we got some things about Romania. I've got to get you to meet this girl, too. I think if you're from Romania and you're in Richmond, it's okay.
It's okay.
although,
if you're from the western part, that means you're close to Hungary, right?
In my class this week on the front row, I have three young ladies from Afghanistan. Two of those, their families have immigrated to the United States. One, the family is still in Afghanistan. And that young lady told me, my parents are trying to get out, but my goal is to become a doctor and go back. I want to go and serve my people. I'm here because I can get an education here. I can't get one there. But when I get my education, I want to go back. The front row of my class is a mission field. Turns out so is the second row, so is the third row, so is the fourth row. It's interesting what's happening at Richmond this year. 23% international, up from 11% last year. Was that the
28% of anything other than the
majority? Yeah, there's a pretty big jump in what people euphemistically call diversity. Anyway, that has little to do with this, except I'm glad to know somebody else can read something. Okay. If you look at what happens next, starting in verse 12, Nathan the prophet begins to scheme with Bathsheba, Solomon's mother. They see what Adonijah is doing. David is old and isn't paying attention. And it looks like some palace intrigue takes place. And in the palace intrigue, they go to David. It's not clear that what they ask David to do is based on things he has said before. They tell him, you remember you told us that Solomon was going to be king, but there's no Bible record before this that says he ever said that. So it's not clear how this came to be, but David declared Solomon to be king, and all of a sudden Adonijah is running for his life. Solomon ascends to the throne in the middle of palace intrigue. He ends up executing Adonijah because Adonijah is still trying to supplant him. It's a fairly ugly story. That's how Solomon became king. At the end of Solomon's life, Rehoboam becomes king. Let's take a look at that for just a moment. First Kings chapter 12. First Kings chapter 12. Verse 1, Rehoboam went to Shechem, all Israel having come to Shechem to proclaim him king. Remember, the temple hasn't been built here, so the worship center is in a place called Shechem. And they spoke as follows to Rehoboam. Your father laid a cruel yoke on you. If you will lighten your father's cruel slavery. Does yours use words that strong? Does yours say words that strong? I just jumped down to verse 4, so you may have lost your place as I made that jump from verse 1 to verse 4. Rehoboam went to Shechem, all Israel having come to Shechem to proclaim him king. Tail end of verse 3, they spoke as follows to Rehoboam. This is an assembly of people. Verse 4, your father laid a cruel yoke on us. If you will lighten your father's cruel slavery, that heavy yoke which he imposed on you, we are willing to serve you. Did yours use the word slavery in that verse?
No.
What does it say? Hard. Say, harsh labor. Okay. The evidence was that as Solomon began his building campaign, built the temple and built other things. I say the temple wasn't built. It had just been built, so this worship center was still there. All of that was done, apparently, with slave labor, and not all the slaves were outside of Israel. Some of the slaves were people in Israel. The taxes were so high, you would sell your children into slavery, and all of a sudden, it looked like they had built up a system under Solomon where most of the people in Israel were slaves. And they said to Rehoboam, if you will lighten that slavery, we will serve you. And he said to them, what did he say in verse 5? Go away, come back in 3 days, and I'll give you my answer. And in the verses that follow, verse 6, he consults someone. Who does he consult? The elders. Verse 8, tail end of the verse, who does he consult? The younger folks who were in attendance on him. What did the elders say? If you can skim through verse 6 and 7 and the first part of verse 8. The elders said, do what the people ask. The slavery that Solomon had put in, it can't be sustained. You can't build a nation where most of the people are in slavery serving a few. That's untenable. What did the young people give him as advice? This is verse 8, verse 9, verse 10. What did they say? They said, pour it on. Make it worse. And 3 days later, you have to jump down to verse 12, Rehoboam came and said, my father made your yoke heavy. I'll make it heavier still. My father controlled you with a whip. I'm going to use scorpions. And what happened was there was a revolt. And a good part of the country, a ninth, a tenth of the country was left in his control and most of it was gone. This is the split into the northern and southern kingdoms. Okay?
How did they become slaves?
The taxes are high. You can't pay your taxes. You want to keep your property. So you pay your taxes with your children. And enough time goes by, all of a sudden, most everybody's a slave. That's the picture that I get. It's not perfectly clear, but that's what seems to have happened. Now, did anybody notice Jeroboam's name popping up in the middle of this? Did you notice his name popping up in this little section in chapter 12? Okay, back up to the bottom of chapter 11. This is verse 26. First word in verse 26, chapter 11. Jeroboam. And it tells you who he was, whose son he was. It tells you where he came from. It's sort of like city and state. This time it's tribe and family and a little city there. His mother was a widow. And then it says something about him. What does it say? Still in verse 26. He had been in Solomon's service, but he revolted. What was his job? Well, let's keep reading. Verse 27, Solomon was building one of the major buildings there and closing the breach in the walls of the city. Jeroboam was a man, it says, of great energy. What does yours say at that point? Man of standing, one says. What did yours say, Judith? Was that it?
Strong and valiant.
Strong and brave.
Strong and brave.
Valiant warrior. Uh-huh. Very able. When you find somebody like that, what do? Put him in charge of stuff. What did he put him in charge of? Mine doesn't use the word slavery here. It used the word forced labor. Does yours use words like that? Okay. So again, those pictures are coming together. Jeroboam was put in charge of all of the forced labor, all the slavery that the word is used later. It's almost like the Bible writer is sort of building the words so you get the stronger words later. Remember, we were already in chapter 12. He was in charge of all that, and he revolted. Now, part of why he revolted was that a prophet had come to him. It names the prophet Ahijah, or Ahijah, depending on how you pronounce that, came to him out on the road and said, you're going to be one of two kings because God is going to split this country in half and you're going to be in charge of the other half. Now, when Solomon found out about all this, verse 40, what did he do? I'm still in chapter 11, verse 40. What did Solomon try to do? Tried to kill him. Now, if the king is trying to kill you, what do you do? Run for your life. He ran to Egypt. So the picture is that when Solomon died, Jeroboam came back. And that's the parenthetical that's in verse 2 and verse 3 of chapter 12. Jeroboam hears that it's done. Now, I'm not sure all of what happened, but the picture seems to be Solomon had all this forced labor going on, brought Jeroboam, a very able and valiant person, to be in charge of it, and after being in charge of it for a little while, it was sickening him. This isn't the way it ought to go. And as he began to rebel against this, Solomon decided to have him killed. And in the middle of it, his revolting against Solomon was confirmed by one of God's prophets, who said to him, God is in this. So now we have these three people, right? All three were failures. If you jump forward to chapter 13, chapter 12, verse 26. Chapter 12, verse 26. My translation says, Jeroboam bought to himself. The split has now taken place. Jeroboam is in charge of the northern kingdom. Jerusalem, the center of worship of the temple, is still part of the southern kingdom. But Jeroboam has that northern part. And my translation said, he bought to himself, and then there's a quotation mark, and it says, well, he bought to himself. Does yours have a phrase like that? Okay. Now, what did he think? He thought, all these people that are now in my kingdom, they're still going to go back to Jerusalem to worship. That means their allegiance is really going to be towards the southern kingdom. That's their orientation of all their thinking and their worship. And eventually what that's going to do is pull them back into the sphere of influence of the southern kingdom. I will not be able to sustain what I have here. And so he said, what am I going to do about that? Have you skimmed far enough to find out the answer to that? Verse 28. What do you make?
Two golden calves.
And he said to the people, look, here is your God who brought you out of Egypt. Anybody remember what happened just as the children of Israel came out of Egypt?
Yes.
Moses goes up on the mountain. Aaron, I think, was left behind. And Aaron says, give me all the gold, because they came out of Egypt with lots of gold. And he told Moses later, I threw it in the furnace and look what came out. What came out? A golden calf. And they were all worshiping that. First commandment, thou wilt have no other gods before me. Before he came back down off the mountain, they'd already shattered that one. So now, this guy makes two golden calves. And where does he place them? He places them at the border between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, and then another one way up in the north. And he says, okay, if you're going to worship, go worship one of these two things. And God says, that's it. You weren't listening to me. You weren't following me. The kingdom's going to be taken away from you. Right? All three were failures. As great, as mighty, as powerful as Solomon's kingdom was, the strength and power and vitality of his kingdom did not last one king's worth past him. It all split apart. You cannot call that a success. Rehoboam, the people were ready to serve him. The split would not have taken place if he had not said, what my father did to you is nothing compared to what I'm going to do to you. And here's Jeroboam. God gave him a kingdom. And Jeroboam throws it away because he's not following God. Three kings in two sets, right? Solomon and then these two sort of lined up together. And they're all three failures. So the question I have for you this morning is, what can we learn from these three people? What caused the failure? Let's take them one at a time, and let's not start with Solomon. Solomon's the hard one. So let's start with Rehoboam. He took some bad advice.
Pride and arrogance. Almost more than, you thought my father was tough, watch what I do.
There was a comparison with his father, and he wanted to make sure he came out looking stronger and harsher and all that. Okay? Pride and arrogance. There's a place in the Bible where it says God hates pride. He cannot deal with people who have pride. He cannot deal graciously with people who have pride. It might be enough to say about them. He didn't consult. He consulted with the elders, but he didn't see the wisdom of what they had to say. He consulted with the young people. What did he not do? Do you notice what he did not do? And I'm saying this in part because of Wednesday night of this past week. What did he never, ever, ever do? He never put them together. He never brought the two groups together to say, okay, I'm getting different advice from the two. Let's talk about this. Why are you saying this? Why are you saying this? And doing that in a transparent way where each group can know what the other group is saying and do that. That's very difficult work for politicians. That's real tough. They would a lot rather keep everybody divided than they can sort of stand back and make some decisions. Yeah?
You mean it's all about us?
Yeah, and I think Rehoboam fell into that trap. I'm going to make the decision, and he chose the wrong ones to listen to. Tom, I need my sign, and I still think it's hidden behind there somewhere. But those of you who've been here for a while will know I have a sign that says "Dangerous Ground." I'm going to stand firmly on that for a minute. Teddy Kennedy died this week. If people wanted to, the United States got a chance to see a 2.5-hour service devoted to talking about a person for whom, whatever else you think, family had become important. That was followed by a funeral service at the gravesite that ended up with the delays in the first service going into the dark hours. Did you hear how important family was to that fella? And when they started talking about him, they said one of the best things that could have happened. Now, I'm part affected by what I've read in Time magazine this week. They had some articles about this as well. One of the writers or one of the commentators said it may have been that the best thing that ever happened to Teddy Kennedy was losing the chance to be president in 1980 because it freed him up to be a legislator for the rest of his life. As liberal as he was, as firmly, proudly liberal as he was, did you hear what they kept saying about him? He was close friends with Orrin Hatch, one of the most conservative Republicans that could be. And together they built legislation. And you start looking at the things he worked on. He worked on things that affected the poor. Whether you agree with how he decided to help the poor with his legislation, that was his aim and that was his focus. And he seemed to be bringing people together. And as I listened to all of this, I started to realize there's not too many people in Washington you can say that about these days. So whatever else I may have with agreements or disagreements with his particular policies, I think I can say here was somebody who kept bringing people together to say, look, there's goals that we want to accomplish. How can we work together to get those things done? Setting Teddy Kennedy up as an example for this kind of thing, I don't know that I would have thought of doing that, except I watched some of what they said.
And the individual people he helped, the only that he didn't know about,
are starting to come forward.
Mm-hmm. And great story of redemption when we know, like biblical characters, mm-hmm. things they went through.
They read a letter at the graveside, I think, that he had written to the Pope and had Barack Obama hand carried to the Pope. And they read a little bit from that. He confessed his faults. He didn't try to cover over them. It was a beautiful letter. It was beautiful. I still think I disagree with some of the things he espoused, but there's something there to admire. Rehoboam missed a chance to hold his kingdom together, to have the kind of effect that the best of kings could have had. He threw it all away. Pride and arrogance led him to listen to the wrong advisors, take the wrong advice. Yes, sir.
This is part of Senator Kennedy's death. A few days ago, one of the newscasts had John McCain on, and he said that one of the most remarkable things about Senator Kennedy was that he had the ability to separate the essential from the peripheral in negotiations and move forces forward to accomplish things. I thought this was a very interesting comment.
And one of the comments I heard was there is no one right now in the Democratic Party to take his place, and they're not sure there's anybody in the Republican Party to match him. And that says something about leadership. Again, look at the situation. Pride and arrogance led Rehoboam not to try to bring people together. He's getting advice from here, it's in contrast, it's in conflict. He chooses the wrong one. I'm almost convinced no matter which one he chose, it probably wouldn't have worked if he had not brought these groups together.
What about our church with the young people and the young people?
Wednesday night is just looming over this, and I didn't realize it, how big it was going to loom over it when I first started thinking about this. Okay? Now, let's go to Jeroboam for a minute. Now, I'm going to take you somewhere that I don't think very many of you have been. I think there's few in the room who are going to know what I'm about to show here. Lloyd might, a couple of you might, but not many will. Tell me what was special about David. What was God's analysis of David? He said David was a man after my own heart. And he promised David a permanent, lasting kingdom. Right? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. Go to chapter 11 of 1 Kings. Remember, that was the section that talked about Jeroboam, right? I read you the part up at the first, around verse 26, 27, 28, sort of what Jeroboam was doing and the problems he had. And I read verse 40, right? But I want to now read for you verse 37 and 38 and maybe 39, especially verse 38. God is speaking through the prophet, through the man of God, Ahijah. You nonetheless I will appoint to rule over as much of Israel as you wish. You will be king of Israel. There's a period there and a new sentence starts. If you listen to all my orders and follow my ways, if you do what I regard as right, if you keep my laws and commandments as my servant David did, then I will be with you and I will build you as enduring a dynasty as the one I built for David. I will build. This is Jeroboam that God is speaking to. Jeroboam had the chance to be a second David. And I had not known that before. Have you guys seen that before? I will build you as enduring a dynasty as I did for David. And Jeroboam threw that all away. Why? What was the fatal flaw for Jeroboam? For Rehoboam, it was pride and arrogance. For Jeroboam, it's a little different. Can you see it? These are negative lessons this week. Are you picking up on that? These are negative lessons on this week. Be careful about pride and arrogance. That's the one that can just kill any relationship with God. What's this one? What's this one? Louder?
Jeroboam
breaking the commandments?
Breaking the commandments? Yeah, but I don't think that goes to something that helps us see it quite as clearly. Why did he break the commandments? What was his rationale or reason? I took you to that verse. Verse 26. Verse 27 in chapter 12. Ambition. He did not trust God to do what God said he would do. He broke God's commandments in order to accomplish what God had said he would do. I can't trust God to do this. Ambition that trumps trusting God. Do you see it? Okay. So now let's go back to Solomon. You're getting the idea of what I'm looking for. What was the fatal flaw with Solomon? When Solomon first became king, God came to him and said, "What is it you want?" And what did he ask for? He asked for wisdom. And God granted that wisdom, right? Let me ask that again. God granted that wisdom, right? So how could Solomon have done so many stupid things?
All the while, yeah.
But where was the wisdom? That's what I can't figure out. So why? How did he get in all that trap? So then he ended up with all the...
First Kings 11. First Kings 11. Verse 1. It is not the fault of the women, but boy, are they involved. Chapter 11, verse 1. King Solomon loved many foreign women, not only Pharaoh's daughter, but, and they're all plural, Moabites, Edomites, Sidonites, Hittites, from those people of whom the Lord had said to the Israelites, "You are not to go among them, nor they among you, or they will be sure to sway your hearts to their own gods." But Solomon was deeply attached to them. 700 wives of royal rank and over 300 mistresses. Busy boys. When Solomon grew old, his wives swayed his heart to other gods, and his heart was not holy with God as his father David's has been. Now, look at verse 7. And you'll start to see the nature of the problem. Solomon had built the temple, right? Solomon had built the temple. What was supposed to happen in the temple? This is simple. What was supposed to happen in the temple? The worship of God. Okay? Instead, what did Solomon do? In addition to the temple, verse 7 of chapter 11, he built worship places for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on a mountain to the east of Jerusalem, and to Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives. All of them. Hold for a moment and turn, don't lose your place, but turn to 2 Kings chapter 23. There's a later king called Josiah, who cleaned up the temple from some of this stuff. Chapter 23 of 2 Kings. Chapter 23 of 2 Kings. I'll take you just to verse 7. This whole section will show you how bad it was. I'm taking you to one particular one. He pulled down the house of the sacred male prostitutes, fertility gods worshipped by having sex. There were female prostitutes in one house of worship. There were male prostitutes in another. He pulled down the house of the male sacred male prostitutes. Where was it located? Inside the temple of the Lord. And where the women wove veils for Asherah, that's the female sacred prostitutes. Fertility gods you worship by going and having sex with them. Where was that located? It was located all around where the temple was, and it was located inside where the temple was. If you keep reading, he had things to the sun god sitting up at the entrance to the temple. He had stuff inside the temple, and it was all going on. This didn't happen years later. This all happened when Solomon was king. So what was Solomon's problem? And I think it is way different from what you jumped to. His heart was swayed
I think he didn't stick to his original beliefs.
I think so.
He was influenced by so many other things.
I think so, too.
His original belief was that one, there was one true God, and he was going to build that temple to the one true God.
And then his heart was
full. 400 years after they got out of Egypt, so they finally got there.
And he finally built this thing, okay? We're running out of time, so let me help you. The problem wasn't that he got pulled away, I think. The problem was there was no influence in his life to pull him back. Nathan was a prophet to David, and at a critical moment, he went to David, put his finger in his face, and said, "You did wrong." If you read a little further, you'll read about Jeroboam. Jeroboam put up these two calves, and a prophet came to him and put his finger in his face and said, "You did wrong." But there's no prophet that came to Solomon and put his finger in his face. And that, I think, I am indebted to Ravi Zacharias for that. I think he's right, and I'd never thought of that before. It was a huge problem that he was pulled away from a singular worship of God. But a worse problem was he didn't let any influence in his life pull back. Why not? Because God has given me all the wisdom I need. I don't need anybody else's wisdom. And they shut the door. Let's put these together. What's going to kill you as a child of God in terms of having any influence, having any kind of life that really begins to shine God's love and God's glory can see through it? Pride is going to kill that. Arrogance is going to kill it. What else is going to do that? Ambition that's tied to your own efforts and not tied to what you and God together can do. And third, cutting out from your life any source of influence that holds you accountable to be true to what God says. There are powerful lessons to learn from Kings. Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, it's almost as if we've been warned this morning. There are things that we can do that can break the effectiveness that comes out of our relationship with you, that can destroy all the influence and all the good that we might do. Help us understand these things, that you do not want pride and arrogance to be in your children. You want humility. You do not want raw ambition as the world defines success. You want people to work with you and your spirit in the accomplishment of things. And into each Christian life, you want there to be somebody that can act to hold us accountable. Someone who can be your voice to say, you're doing something wrong. You need to be careful. When those voices come, help us listen. When those times of opportunity come, help us listen to your voice and how we approach those. And help us always remember how deeply dependent we are on you. All this we ask in your Son's name. Amen.